Hello, this is Hugh Baird, and I'm your moderator for today's discussion. I'm here with State Senator Jim Brewster, and we want to welcome you to this live telephone town hall. If you have a question for Senator Brewster and his guest today at any point, press star 3, that's star 3 on your phone's keypad. Now I would like to welcome Senator Jim Brewster.
Thank you, Hugh, and thank you to all of you area residents participating in today's call. I'm Senator Jim Brewster, and I'm holding this live telephone town hall talk about the coronavirus. The special guest of mine, Dr. Joe Tsuyama, Chief of Emergency Services from the UPMC's McKee Women's Hospital, and answer any questions that you may have. This format will allow you to listen in and ask questions from the comfort of your home. If you'd like to ask a question at any time, please press star 3 on your phone. And we're about to get started.
Thank you, Senator. As we're having folks join us and as we get some folks that question, and if you have a question for Senator Brewster today, you can press star 3. That's star 3 on your phone's keypad. Senator, before we begin answering questions from those that are coming online now, can we ask the doctor just to give us a brief update as to where we are relative to the COVID-19 pandemic and just the status? Doctor?
Yes, hi. Good evening, good late afternoon. Thank you for having me. Really appreciate the opportunity. And thank you, Senator Brewster. I'm sure that these meetings have been very informative for you and your constituency. This is a very important time to get good information out to the public related to a medical condition that we now know as the coronavirus pandemic. COVID-19 is a disease that we take very seriously because it has the potential to devastate our population with not only significant amount of death, but also with the disruption which we need to take advantage of at this time. Throughout the world, we are seeing cases, that's why it's a pandemic. It's a worldwide experience. Now, over 450,000 people have been known to have acquired the disease with greater than 20,000 deaths. Many have recovered, but many are still in that stage where they are in the hospital or still being monitored. In the United States, those numbers are climbing rapidly, and there is truth to the fact that we will likely be the next country to take the lead, even above Italy and China. In the cases, we currently sit about 64,000 with nearly 900 people who have passed away, and we continue to monitor that very closely. Locally, we have now had our own experience, and I would say there's a fortunate portion of this because our numbers are still low, and I attribute that to a lot of the social distancing that had been put in place in a just-in-time kind of fashion. We have over 1,100 cases in Pennsylvania currently, and that number will continue to grow daily. So I would encourage those of you who are interested in getting local information about the Commonwealth and even your counties to go visit the Pennsylvania Department of Health website, where there's a good deal of accurate information about the disease and where it is in our state. Westmoreland County has a documented 16 confirmed cases in Allegheny 88. And those numbers will continue to grow as we see the effects of the pandemic as it goes from international to national and now into Western Pennsylvania.
Well, Doctor, thank you very much. For those that have just joined us, if you have a question this afternoon for Senator Brewster or his special guest, you can press star 3. Again, that's star 3 on your phone's keypad if you have a question. For Senator Brewster is a special guest, Dr. Joe Tsuyama. Doctor, before we bring some of the callers online, can you explain exactly why the social distancing is important and why that's critical in terms of making a dent in terms of the spread of the disease?
For many of you who have been tuning in to this, the reaction of our country and the world to this pandemic, several things have been noted. One is the hospital care is adequate until the numbers go up, and the social distancing that assists in keeping those hospital numbers down have been successful. Social distancing and quarantine measures and allowing people to stay at home and work from home is one of the only and true tested measures that we can use at this point in time that will decrease the likelihood that we will have great harm to our population in Western Pennsylvania. I focus on Western Pennsylvania because we are in a state where, if you make a reference or analogy, the tsunami had hit, and it hit very hard in places around the world, which include Italy and China. And also, when it came to the United States, we had some sense that it would get here. But as that wave came across the United States, we're still feeling the little laps of water that are coming in our direction. And we were fortunate to have the ability to put in place some of the social distancing so that we will maximally benefit from it as opposed to some areas in California and New York. So the social distancing, what it does is it decreases the ability for you to get infected. And for those who are infected, it allows them to rest and recover at home. Obviously, if you are at home with an illness and you feel that you can handle it, please do so, because that is the safest way to keep the community well. But if in any way, shape, or fashion you're experiencing worsening of symptoms, then you do need to seek medical care immediately. But the social distancing, again, will allow those who are recovering at home to stay at home so that others won't get infected, and then allow those who are currently not infected to stay safe. If we can maintain this posture for, you know, as long as it takes for the waves to pass over, then that'll be our best way to make sure that this disease doesn't take a foothold. It already has, as I said. There are plenty of hospitalized cases in Western Pennsylvania, but we know about those cases. What we don't want it to do is to grow in the populace so that it multiplies in that logarithmic fashion.
Well, Doctor, thank you very much. Senator, before we go to the caller, just one reminder for those that have just joined us. If you have a question for Senator Brewster and his special guest, Dr. Joe Soyama, press *3 on your phone's keypad. That's *3 on your phone's keypad. Senator, we're going to go, our first caller today is going to be Debbie in Glassport. Debbie, go ahead. You're live with Senator Brewster and guest.
Yes, hello. I was wondering, what are the best precautions to take when accepting food delivered to your home?
Doctor?
Oh, okay. I will definitely provide you the best potential techniques from an infection prevention perspective. But one of the things that we can never assure of 100% is that if an object is left for you to handle, whether or not that particular object, or food in this case, is itself contaminated on the outside, the food will be fine. What we want to make sure is that if the a delivery person or the person who packaged up your food may have been exposed or is somewhat ill and leaves germs behind, you want to be able to make sure that you don't expose yourself to that. So one of the best precautions is to handle the food in such a way that it doesn't touch many surfaces in your home, or have a designated area that you can clean down very easily so that if the containers do touch that area, you can clean that off very well. So what I would do is technically take food containers out, maybe transfer that food into a clean container you have in your home, dispose of the containers that you had just acquired from the takeout or the delivery, and then simply wash your hands with soap and water for the minimum of 20 seconds or whatever your hand washing song is, and then disinfect and clean the surface that the containers were applied to. And then, of course, wash your hands once again. You can never wash your hands too much or use hand sanitizer, so that's definitely the number one way, you know, to decrease the chance of infection is hand washing, number one.
Well, Doctor, thank you. Debbie, thank you very much for your question. Senator, are you ready to go back to the, you want to go to another caller?
Yes.
Okay. Senator, we're going to go to Teresa, Teresa in New Kensington. Teresa, go ahead. You're live with Senator Brewster and Gibbs.
Thank you. My friend is very elderly, 88, and she is being evicted, not through any cause of her own, but because the landlady is getting divorced and she wants to sell the house. So she is evicting her on April 18th. And I'm wondering, is that legal? during this time of the virus?
Teresa?
Yes.
Evictions and home foreclosures are on hold right now.
Okay.
I would let her know that. And frankly, okay. I would refer her to my office in New Kensington if we can help her with that specific issue and that specific property owner. But evictions and home foreclosures are on hold as we go through this epidemic.
Oh, thank you very much.
Teresa, thank you very much for your call. Again, if you have a question for Senator Brewster and his guest today, you can press *3 on your phone's keypad. That's *3 on your phone's keypad. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. Let's go to Eileen. Eileen, go ahead. You're live with Senator Brewster. Eileen, go ahead. You're live with Senator Brewster.
Oh, all right, Senator. My question had been regarding our incoming mail and other papers in our mailboxes or that we're trying to bring in and cardboard materials, plastic. How long can the virus live on these types of materials? Are we safe in handling them and opening our mail?
Doctor, go ahead.
Yeah, from an infection prevention perspective, most of the mail has been auto-handled, et cetera. There is a brief opportunity where a human gets interaction with that. But I think that one of the most important things, again, is to understand that the way you protect yourself from any contact to these materials, whether you feel they're contaminated or not, is to handle them sensibly and to wash your hands afterwards. That is the clear best way to handle any of these circumstances, whether it be a package, whether it's mail or some other type of delivery, is to handle them in a very careful manner and then wash your hands, and that will protect you 100% of the time.
Eileen, thank you very much for your call. Again, if you have a question for Senator Brewster, you can press *3 on your phone's keypad. That's *3 on your phone's keypad. Senator, let's go to Dorothy and Plum. Dorothy, go ahead. You're live with Senator Brewster and guests.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor. My question is, I have macular degeneration. I get the shots in my eye. I was scheduled for a shot this coming Tuesday, but I canceled my appointment. Did I do the right thing? I will be 92 years old in June.
From a medical perspective, hey, you sound great for 92, so congratulations there. But I'm glad that you're still, you know, getting the treatment that you need, and I'm really sorry to hear that you had to delay that. Now, one of the things you may want to do before you cancel any further appointments is just to consult with your doctor to make sure that that's a reasonable decision to make. There are risks and benefits to doing cancellations as well as deferring the treatments, and under the circumstances, you definitely want to talk to your doctors before you make any specific decisions on your own. And in this particular case, you still have time to confirm with your doctor that was the right thing to do for your case, and they'll make the recommendations to either catch up or to defer that for the next time you need to go in.
Dorothy, thank you very much for your question. Senator, we're going to turn to a different question. We're going to go to Philip. Philip, go ahead. You're live with Senator Brewster. Philip, go ahead. You're live with Senator Brewster.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I was reading in the newspaper that Senator Brewster had devised an economic stimulus plan for the state. I was wondering maybe if you could tell us a little bit more about it.
Yes, Phil, thank you. First of all, the federal government, I believe, has come to an agreement today with regard to their federal stimulus package. What I proposed to the governor and to my colleagues in the Senate and the House is that the state do a stimulation package as a companion bill to fill the voids that are not covered in the federal program. And just a few highlights on the federal side, and again, they were supposed to vote this afternoon. The Senate was in session this afternoon, so I'm not sure if they voted or not today. But the federal package is about a $2 trillion recovery package. largest bailout in the history of the United States. Just a few highlights, cash payments up to $1,200 for individuals, $2,400 for married couples, and $500 per child. So there's a total $250 billion set aside for that element of the package. There's a $350 billion fund for small businesses to mitigate layoffs and support payroll. Loans are available. Another $500 billion available for the Treasury Department to make loan guarantees, investments for industries that are damaged by the pandemic. And it goes on the federal side, and there's a significant amount of detail here, but it covers almost every aspect of our population throughout the nation. My state bill would fill the voids. For example, if the unemployment compensation process is expanded or isn't expanded, the state would do that. And just for raw numbers, for example, if you get paid $1,000 a month and you're unemployed because of the pandemic, the unemployment comp may cover $700. It's my proposal the state would pick up the other three to make you whole. Same with small businesses. I'm concerned when I hear about no-interest loans. I believe that's a nice concept on the back end. But what I'm trying to do is calculate, and let's assume that this process, the pandemic lasts 3 months. We want to try and calculate what the revenue loss would be for all small businesses, not just the ones that are out of business as we speak, but those that are still categorized as necessary businesses. They may be operating at a loss, very frankly. So the idea is to calculate what those small businesses would lose over a three-month period. I'm using that as an example, and have the state support that with grant money through bonding and what have you. The state has a very good bond rating as we speak. We could use that as an upfront source. And this would be done if we can make this work without any tax increases. So I don't want anybody to get nervous about that, because someone will start questioning, well, where are you going to get the money? Well, we're going to have to get real creative on other discretionary spending that we have. So the idea and the concept is to have a federal stimulus package complemented by a state stimulus package, not as much emphasis on loans as it is on getting people back on their feet, both small businesses and individuals who may be laid off. So that's sort of an overview. There's significant detail associated with that. But when revenue's lost, it's lost. When you can't sell lunches, you can't sell trophies because all the leagues are shut down for the summer, that's lost revenue. And if you lose that revenue and can't pay the light bill, you're probably not going to be able to pay a low-interest loan. So we're trying to fill that void, and that puts people back to work. And when people are back to work, and of course they spend money, all of a sudden the economy starts to pick up. So that's sort of an overview on where we're at.
Thank you, Senator, and thank you very much for the call. Again, if you have a question for Senator Brewster or Dr. Soyama today, press *3 on your phone's keypad. That's *3 on your phone's keypad. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. Let's go to Denny in Portview. Denny, go ahead. You're live with Senator Brewster.
Good afternoon. I have two questions. I want to know how long after exposure before you feel any symptoms, and when do you expect this to peak in our area, let alone the United States?
No, thank you for the question. Information like that has been looked at, and numbers haven't changed recently in regards to what you're describing as the incubation period. The incubation period is whenever the point where you are exposed to the virus and then expected symptoms will develop. And that generally is between 2 to 14 days.
Okay.
So if somebody exposed you to the virus, you may get symptoms as soon as 2 days after that, or as far as 14 days. So the average or more likely time frame is about five days is the time where you should feel the most of it when it comes to the infection. And that's also another important period of time to watch for. So if you start getting symptoms, regardless of how severe, but from the day one to day about day seven, your symptoms will likely be fairly mild. but it's around that day seven period of time that you want to make sure that if you feel significant worsening of shortness of breath or significant cough, then those are the things you want to talk to your doctor about, because that has a chance of worsening. So incubation is 2 to 14 days. You're most likely to get symptoms starting in about 5 days. And when your symptoms start, you want to make sure you keep an eye on your symptoms till about a week, because if you recover within that week, you're going to do fine. But you want to watch around 7 days to see if you don't get worse. As far as the other question about when the peak may occur, you know, this is all speculation. We may see a small peak if the social distancing is maintained and the virus doesn't take a significant foothold, and we can identify through testing the different pockets of disease in the community. We could also see a large wave if we go back to no social distancing and business as usual, and then you'll start to see maybe the beginning of an early New York type of a phase. But again, today we're not going to know the benefits of what we do. We're only going to know that 14 days from now, and that's largely because of your first question, that incubation period. Once those incubation periods up to 14 days go away, we'll have a better sense of what's happening in the community. As far as the rest of the country, I don't know. I believe that measures are put in place in high volume disease areas like New York, California, Seattle, but we won't know exactly the benefits of that. But having fewer travelers from those areas will make sure that the disease does not spread more rapidly than it needs to.
Denny, thank you very much for your call. Senator, we'll go back to the callers. We're going to go to Valerie. Valerie, go ahead. You're live with Senator Brewster.
Yes, Senator, I had a question about the homeless. I heard yesterday that they don't have access to shelter as they normally would at this time, and I was wondering, because a lot of the hotels or motels that are empty, is it possible to house them? It's so important that they are not forgotten and that they are taken care of.
Thanks, Valerie. Yes, actually, the homeless were specifically addressed in both stimulus packages. That was discussed because nonprofits are also involved in getting reimbursement to keep their shelters and what have you open. For the current process in place for those who are in a situation of being homeless, we want to keep those facilities open. And there has been discussions about using hotels for a variety of different reasons through this pandemic, not just the homeless, but for if in the event the numbers get very large, and that's speculation at this point, and the hospitals become overcrowded and they need to be isolated patients, they've been tested as positive, but may not need the kind of care that you would need, get in an emergency room, that we could also house those folks in a hotel temporarily until they could go home. And be tended. So the whole hotel philosophy is being looked at actually to help hospitals across the state that may need a place for doctors and nurses to rest because many of them are working 20 hours a day. And so there's a number of opportunities to utilize our hotel network for all of those different aspects, Valerie. So thank you.
Valerie, thank you very much for your call. Again, if you have a question for Senator Brewster or a special guest today, Dr. Joe Soyama, press *3, that's *3 on your phone's keypad. Senator, we'll go back to the callers now. Let's go to Patty and Elizabeth. Patty, go ahead, you're live with Senator Brewster.
Hi, this question is for the doctor. I'm concerned about the time frame. I know of someone in the healthcare industry who has been quarantined for 14 days already with symptoms, was not tested. They said there were no tests. But now it's 14 days later and the still showing signs of symptoms and has now been tested for the coronavirus and is being quarantined for another 14 days. Question is, when would you be safe to go back to work after all of this? How would you know that you are now safe to go back into the healthcare industry?
So that's an excellent question. We can give general guidance about returning to work based upon what we know about typical diseases, but testing for cure is at this point impractical. We can We're getting just to the point where we can test who we want from the test availabilities, and as that testing that we want to get to the people who have the disease starts to settle out, then we can start testing for cure, as you're mentioning. And I'm sorry to hear about your friend's situation, but if they were ending up getting positively tested, then they would have to stay in isolation until their symptoms abated. And typically there is also a period you have to be without a fever. So not only do you have to not have symptoms from a respiratory perspective, but you also have to be without a fever, specifically not using fever medications like Tylenol or ibuprofen type medicines. And then afterwards, you can be cleared technically to work. And there are some guidances that state specifically you do need to be tested negatively, but we haven't come to that yet in regards to our ability to test the people coming out of the isolation that they're in.
Patty, thank you very much for your question. Senator, let's go back to the callers. We're going to go to Beverly. Beverly, go ahead. You're live with Senator Brewster.
Thank you, Senator Brewster, for this opportunity. I have two questions for the doctor. One is, how are the doctors treating this if you have mild symptoms and you test positive for the virus and you're told to stay home? Are families supposed to care for people like as if they had the flu? Is Tamiflu being prescribed? What exactly are you supposed to do if you have this? And, you know, you've got mild symptoms, you don't need a respirator, et cetera. That's my first question. Then my second question is, when do the doctors or researchers or whoever's looking at this virus move globally, when will herd immunity kick in 6 months from now, a year from now? Is this going to be reoccurring like the regular flu season? That's what I'd like to know.
Well, thank you very much for the vast number of questions, of which if you have any answers to some of them, I'd like to know as well. This is a very challenging thing. You raise all the important things that we may only know 100% after this is all over. But when it comes to taking care of an individual in your household who's sick, you want to make sure that you understand who's in your household to begin with. The person who's sick needs your love and care. That's 100%. But the good news is if they're doing well in their home, and they don't develop shortness of breath or significant changes that may exacerbate some of their chronic diseases, then you're in good shape. They can be cared for just like if they had a severe flu. You keep them hydrated. You keep their temperature down. The one thing that you're needing to do, though, is, again, understand who's in the household. So if there is a grandmother in the house or if there is a small child or somebody who has underlying medical disease, in this case, diabetes, lung disease, hypertension, they shouldn't be a primary assistant to this person who's sick. They should be, if possible, placed far away in the house so that they have very little communication and more than likely not cross paths in any community setting in the home. So just make sure you understand what's going on in the household, because that's really important to not expose people who don't who wouldn't do well with the condition. If you're caring for somebody, wash your hands, wash the surfaces. If you can dedicate a room to the house for the person who's sick in the bathroom, even better. But I know that those are limitations in many households. But washing your hands is the most important way to diminish the chance they can get you infected or you pick up the infection. Your question about Tamiflu, unfortunately, medications at this point in time that are used for things like influenza are actually not proven to be effective in the COVID infection. It's a different virus family. We can go into that, but that's a really long story. But as you probably heard, there are many studies that are going forth to see if there is any ability to use known medications like hydroxychloroquine, azithromycin, but these are all unproven and could be harmful if taken inappropriately. And definitely there's no evidence to say that it could prevent infection as well. So seek guidance from a medical professional before you take medicines that are prescribed at this time to make sure that you don't use it inappropriately. But feel free to use symptom measures that you can buy over the counter for cough, fever, and use those as directed on the containers. As far as the last question that I heard, and you can correct me if there's more, about the how long it's going to come through our communities and how long do we have to look out for this. Many experts believe that this is something that's going to become endemic, which means it's going to come around season by season after this large peak. It could go away like SARS did in 2003. It's really hard to predict. But if it does become part of our seasonal infections that we see, we don't use the term, I guess, herd immunity when it comes to this type of infection. A herd immunity is only created when there's enough vaccinated people around that can protect the general populace. And so the one thing to remember is that as these infection waves come through, they will affect a percentage of the population. Then that's different than saying effectively vaccinating 95% of the population. So vaccination is the key tool in order to initiate that herd immunity process that you mentioned. And hopefully sometime in the next year to 18 months, we'll have some understanding of if a vaccine is available.
Beverly, thank you very much for your call. Thank you. Thank you, Doctor. Senator, we're going to go to Ron in McKeesport. Ron, go ahead. You're live with Senator Brewster.
Thank you very much, Senator. I just want to take a minute to thank you for the opportunity. You helped us set a business up in McKeesport. We're new business owners, and obviously we're just concerned about the financial ramifications of this. My question was, I'm just curious, is there any talk around Harrisburg of the impact of this financial downturn and how long that may last?
Thanks, Ron. Yes, that discussion is being had on the federal and the state level. As you know, some states really aren't quite at the numbers that we're seeing in say, New York or Pennsylvania, in California, and so on. Some of the other states in the Midwest, they're going to address that issue probably differently than us. What we're trying to do is watch the curve. There's a what we consider to be a number, a plateau of what's a number that we can manage through our health network. And I don't want to speak for the doctor, but we know that there's only a certain number of beds, hospitals, and other facilities available in each state. So as we see the numbers coming in, and I didn't see today's numbers yet in Pennsylvania, but they've been doubling in some cases. So we expect that to increase. The doctor may have an opinion on that when I'm done, but as we get more ability to test, we'll probably find more cases, some that are in different stages of the 14-day incubation period. So we're going to look at those numbers. As those numbers flatten out and we feel that we have some control from a medical perspective over the general public, then we will start granting probably more waivers on the state level. Some of the necessary businesses that have to be open are pretty self-explanatory, grocery stores, pharmacies, and facilities like that. But as we see those numbers flatten out, you'll see probably a backing off of restrictions in terms of what can and cannot be done, both from a social relationship perspective. In other words, ball games and that sort of thing, which are not necessary. We're a long way from that, but as far as getting people back to work, that's what our goal is. When we see there's a control point in place, then you'll see a relaxation of what facilities can reopen. So it's really a difficult task to balance that. If we do it too soon, we could extend the pandemic further in Pennsylvania. If we wait too long, we create more of a financial breakdown. So it's a balancing act right now. I can tell you that, and I can assure you that from the governor on down, all the way down to your local mayors and council people, everyone are involved with this discussion based on where you're located. And so I think you're going to be comfortable in knowing that it's not just going to be a guess, that there's going to be some analysis done both financial and medical, working with our doctors and having them tell us where they think we're at. And I would guess, and the doctor may respond as well, you may see folks that are just coming down with it. You may see folks that are already through it. That's my guess, and I think we're seeing that. We did have one individual that passed away in Pennsylvania. I don't think this is confidential information. And she was diagnosed after the death. So that's kind of a telling story in terms of how long this virus has been in Pennsylvania. So that's sort of a lengthy discussion, Ron, but it's a calculation that we're making with input from all the experts on every aspect of the issue.
Dr. Do you have anything to add?
Yeah, no, Senator Brewster, I think you handled that question appropriately from all sides, so I agree that it is a multidisciplinary task to look at the medical, public health, and the economic circumstances. But understanding that what is happening on other parts of the state, it may not reflect what's happening statewide, so there's a possibility, like I think Governor Wolf was doing, is looking at each county by county and determining the risk and using that as a way to look at it from a health or public health perspective, and even maybe from an economic perspective. But I think you covered it all, yes.
Thank you, Doctor, and thank you, Ron. Senator, we'll go back to the callers. Let's go to Rosemarie. Rosemarie, go ahead. You're live with Senator Brewster.
Okay, my question is for the doctor. They're saying people should not wear masks. However, when you go to the grocery store, I can stay 6 feet away from somebody, but I may walk down an aisle where someone coughed and the droplets are still in the air. My question is, how long do these droplets stay in the air, and should I wear a mask? I do have some pre-existing conditions.
So that's an excellent question. Again, the way that the disease is known to transmit is from person-to-person contact. Person-to-person contact, because the secretions that somebody has can get onto you, which then will be applied to your face, your eyes, so it gets into your body. We talked about the different surfaces. There is some research going into how long does the virus stay on surfaces themselves, and that's not fully known at this point in time. But again, the most likely way that you get it is if somebody shakes your hand, somebody coughs on you, and then you subsequently touch your mucous membranes, your eyes, your mouth, and then that's where the virus gets into your system. Now, a virus that hangs out in the air for a long period of time is called aerosolizable infection. Those are the kind of infections like measles, chickenpox, tuberculosis, which we know that they hang around for hours or even longer. And those are the highest risk when it comes to passing it from person to person in that coughing through the air perspective. But the big droplets that you're talking about, the snot, so to speak, they don't hang around for that long. But if somebody does cough on you, that direct inoculation can get you infected. As far as wearing a mask, you know, that's a risk-benefit on individuals, and it's one of the things that we would encourage in high-risk situations or with high-risk individuals. So, and, you know, it's one of the things where if you can get them, you know, we in the healthcare system are lucky that we are getting priority with distribution of medication or masks and those things, and so we feel comfortable that we know where they're coming from and we'll have them when we need them. And if the community has them as well, then it could be useful for those that are highest risk, but it's not the best way to prevent infection. Again, it's about making sure that the contact that you have is followed by hand washing and making sure that you practice that social distancing, because that's the best way that those droplets don't get to you, and also staying away as many opportunities as you can, so the social distancing in your home.
Rosemarie, thank you very much for your call. Again, if you have a question for Senator Brewster and his special guest today, Dr. Joe Soyama, please press *3, that's *3 on your phone's keypad. Senator, we're going to go out to Baldwin. We're going to go to Kathy in Baldwin. Kathy, go ahead. You're live with Senator Brewster.
Hi. I would like to talk to the doctor. I have two questions. One, my 98-year-old mother was living in her own apartment with home care coming three times a week. We suggested that she go stay with my sister, and my sister wanted me to come out and visit on Sunday. I am having radiation right now and chemo, and when I go to radiation, I sit in the car till they call me. Then I go in, and the only people I'm in contact with are the three technicians, and then I get back in the car. I wipe everything, and I get back in the car. Now, is it safe for me to be around my mother? She is 98. She gets pneumonia easy. You know, I don't know what do you think? I feel like I'm rambling.
Well, thank you for sharing such a personal story, and the way I can answer this question will probably help lots of people, so it's a very important thing you brought up. Well, first of all, you have, it sounds like, some risk in yourself, but you are treated appropriately by making sure that the staff and everybody does their thing to make sure that you are at the least risk of getting exposed. So that's number one. So your risk goes down because of the precautions that you're taking, as well as the staff of the hospital. Just because you're going to the hospital doesn't actually place you at greater risk at this time. Now, your mother in her environment is also safe. And so what you're asking is since I'm the only one that's coming in from the outside, what is my risk to my mother? And the answer is because you are in a protected state yourself, you're doing everything you can to protect yourself from getting infected, then you are a minimal risk to your mother.
Okay.
Now, if you were to somehow develop symptoms, such as fever, even a bit of cough, then those are things that you would want to make sure you don't introduce into the household. Whether it's the rhinovirus, you know, the common cold, or influenza, I think that's a good statement in general. And then if you really needed to be around her, you would have to wear a mask. And so as the other caller had mentioned, to protect yourself against somebody else's snot by wearing a mask, not so much the benefit. It's the benefit is if you're sick, it decreases your chance to aerosolize out snot. So maybe the better answer to the caller's question from before is that if somebody's coughing in public, I'd give them a mask, and then that would prevent them from putting their secretions out there. So hopefully that's helpful. But again, what you're doing sounds very prudent. It sounds like you're decreasing all the risks necessary, and it wouldn't be unreasonable if you continue to go. And just monitor your symptoms, that's all.
Okay, second question. It might sound bizarre, but somebody, does putting Neosporin up your nose help at all for breathing in bad stuff?
So that's an interesting question, and
somebody
mentioned
it, and I don't know.
So I don't want to mislead anyone. So the answer is no. The Neosporin has a different antimicrobial effect against viruses in general, and specifically COVID. So no, it doesn't decrease the chance that you'll get an infection because it doesn't have any effect against viruses. And then I'll just throw out there, though, you know, if you have something that's bothering your nose a lot and you tend to touch your face now because of it, then that's an increased risk. So anything that makes you manipulate your face, your mouth, that's the big thing is we are now being more cautious about washing our hands, but we're also understanding how often we touch our face. And so anything that makes you touch your face more is definitely a bad thing. And I could think that Neosporin up your nose would make you want to, I don't know, touch your face. So.
Well, Kathy, thank you very much for a call. Senator, before we get to our next caller, I know that you have excellent information. It's on your website and on your Facebook page. Can you talk a little bit about that before we go to our next caller?
Yes, thank you, Hugh. We are updating our website and our Facebook, and I would recommend anybody listening to the call to log on to my website, Senator Brewster, Senator Jim Brewster, on the internet, and of course our Facebook. What I'm doing is I'm relaying every document I receive from the governor's office and any other organization that's making legislative decisions that would be important to for people, whether it's education, whether it's be health and safety, what's closed and what isn't closed, what's an essential business and what isn't, how to apply for a waiver. All that information is on my website. Because there's so much, it's difficult to communicate to everybody who has an interest. And I will also say this, my offices are still taking phone calls on a daily basis for folks that don't get through on a call tonight or have a question that they didn't think of tonight. Feel free to call the offices. We'll get the answer for you and call you back. So please use the communication networks that we have in terms of Facebook and the website. There isn't an answer that I know that isn't on there in much more detail, I might add. Thank you,
thank you, Senator. Again, the website that folks can go to is senatorbrewster.com, and the Facebook page is at Senator Jim Brewster. So that's senatorbrewster.com for information and resources on the COVID-19 pandemic, and the Senator also has it on his Facebook page at Senator Jim Brewster. Senator, let's go back to the callers now. We're going to go to Gary in Duquesne. Gary, go ahead. You're live with Senator Brewster.
Yeah, my question is, if you're diabetic or asthmatic, and are you in a high-risk group? And also, if you're older person, too. My son is younger, but I'm older. Like, I'm 71, and he's 44. He's asthmatic and diabetic. I'm just diabetic. All right. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. And the answer is yes. The category of higher risk is based upon age with this particular infection, as well as the presence of systemic illnesses such as diabetes, hypertension, and underlying lung disease. With controlled asthma, it's less of a potential concern, but it is still concerning when it comes to the potential for the disease to progress. So unfortunately, you did mention a few things. So, you know, please continue to distance yourself, wash your hands effectively, and those are the best ways to make sure that, regardless of your underlying risk, that you don't get exposed to the disease.
Gary, thank you very much for your call. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. We're going to go to Christina in North Versailles. Christina, go ahead. You're live with Senator Brewster.
Hello. Yes. My question is for the doctor. For an elderly person that never received any of the pneumonia vaccines, would you recommend them getting the Pneumovax 13 or 23 at this time? Thank you.
No, thank you for the question. Medical professionals in general will 100% back vaccinations, influenza seasonally, and the Pneumovax when necessary. The question is would you be able to get it at this time? And that would be, you know, an extra trip for you. Since it's heading into the summer, a little less of a respiratory, aside from the coronavirus out there, we'll start to see them decline in general. But it's always useful to have that vaccination in your pocket. But to answer your question about getting the vaccination now, the only downside sometimes is to any vaccination, although it's effective in protecting you against the illness that it's used for, you may develop a little body ache, a little low-grade temperature, and under these circumstances may be confused for symptoms that could be COVID-related. That would be the only confounder at this point. So 100% agree vaccinations are useful and recommended to prevent illness and from going forward. But to your question about, you know, making a special trip for it right now, not so sure. Maybe 2 months from now, and definitely before the fall would be a good time to get that vaccination.
Christina, thank you very much for your call. Senator, let's go back to the callers. Let's go to Lower Borough. Janet, go ahead. You're live with Senator Brewster.
It's not a question. I wanted to talk to Senator Brewster. I just wanted to tell him that I wanted to thank him for doing this. I mean, I see that somebody in Pennsylvania is really looking out for us, and it was a really good deed for him to do this. That's it.
Okay, thank you, Janet.
Let me respond. Janet, thank you for the call. One of the things we're trying to do electronically is really give everybody in the district, actually in the Commonwealth, an opportunity to get feedback, because it's so difficult to get through on the phone lines and on the emails. So we recognize that, and I want to give the credit to my staff. We have a wonderful staff, and outreach is important to us. So, Janet, thank you for the call. And if there's any suggestions to make this even better, please let us know. So thank you.
Janet, thank you very much for your call. Senator, let's go back to the callers. We're going to go to Nancy. Nancy, go ahead. You're live with Senator Brewster.
Thank you, Senator Brewster, for taking my call. I have two questions. The first one is, what kind of precautions should you take on a domestic flight? And the second question you sort of answered, I had recently read an article that in South Korea, they're starting to see improvements because more of the population are wearing the mask. Does that really make a difference if more of the population here wears a mask going out? Thank you.
Yes, so the domestic flight question is both twofold. Is the airline does have a responsibility to make sure the cabin is clean. For your personal protection, the idea of being in close quarters for a long period of time and potentially sharing the same airspace is sometimes daunting to think about. But again, as I had mentioned, the hand hygiene is still the number one thing you can do. So avoid touching the shared surfaces, the common and high touch areas of anything. And if you were to do so, either perform hand hygiene using the hand sanitizer or be able to wash your hands for at least that minimum of 20 seconds. The issue of the mask is an interesting one because it really has to do with the risk and benefits. There's definitely a consensus about using the masks if you are sick to decrease the amount of droplets that you personally will express into the environment. So there is a lot of people behind that. The other way around, though, it has to do with the type of mask or even respirator that you're wearing, because in many cases, the high-end respirators create a resistance for people to breathe. And so it might protect you from a lot of particles, but if you have underlying lung disease, you're working that much harder to entrain air through a device that provides resistance. And they're not completely benign without potential risks on their own. When it comes to the face masks themselves, there are two arguments against wearing them 100% of the time, and one is that they may induce you again to touch your face more than you would do normally without having the mask on. So that's number one. Number two is the supply issue, which is, although looking better in some areas for the hospitals, still dire though in many locations as well. It would be considered potentially wasteful to use them on a daily basis in a country as large as ours. But I think that we won't know the best answer to that until we look at all the data from other countries. But I do think that the mask itself is a good representation of somebody who's paying attention to making sure that they're protecting themselves and others. And so I also, on the other hand, think that it does make a statement. And in making a statement and understanding that you're doing your job to distance yourself, to make sure you're handling your secretions, I think that is a condition where the mask is a useful reminder. And also, to your point, may provide some general protection. But there are some pros and cons, and hopefully I've laid them out well enough for you.
Nancy, thank you very much. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. Let's go to Georgianne. Georgianne, go ahead. You're live with Senator Brewster.
Hello. Thanks for taking these calls, Senator. I just want to thank you for all your help that you give all the communities around here, and thanks for doing this with the doctor. And the other question, the first question is with the doctor, is the medical personnel encouraged by the numbers coming out of China that they're reducing?
Well, the answer is yes. Anytime we can see a peak and you see that the levels have gone down because of the measures that have been enacted, that's definitely the goal. A lot of it had to do with the internal health care that was provided and the places to isolate people and also the social distancing. All those things have proven, I think hopefully to the world, that enacting these measures, keeping people at a distance, doing the quarantines as we're doing in our country, the 15 days, as you just heard from the federal government, 15 days to stop the virus. These are all important measures because we've seen historically and then also during this pandemic that they are effective. The one thing that we do need to step up with in our country is the next part of that, which is not only do you have to social distance between the people who are sick and who are not sick is that you need to start identifying in the community who might be carriers or who might have mild disease and continue to isolate them as well. And the only way you're going to know that is with testing. And so as our testing increases across the country, we'll be able to get that same state as the folks in China were able to do. So it's not only about putting in the processes to treat and help the patients who are sick, then social distance, but also test and make sure that you identify all the pockets in the community that disease might be hiding.
Doctor, could you actually be a carrier and not have any symptoms whatsoever?
So the jury is 100% it's not known. There is a probability that the younger you are, that it's possible that you could carry it without having symptoms or have minimal symptoms. So it is unknown, that true risk. So that's why that these periods of time where we're distancing ourselves will help us declare one way or the other whether we're sick or not. And regardless if we weren't sick, 14 days later, you are unlikely to be able to pass on the infection even if it passed through your body. So that's the important thing that I think the community is doing now. I've actually commented, and I've had friends from across the country who are talking about different the value of social distancing and how things are working in their communities. But I can tell you in Westmoreland and Allegheny County, I think that we're doing a very good job, and it's going to benefit everyone in the long run. So if you're indoors for that 14, 21, who knows, maybe even longer 28-day period of time, it makes the disease go away in the communities to a point where those who are infected will hopefully ride through the disease. Those who are not exposed won't get the disease, and then will come out better in the long run. The other thing about being social distance at this time, and as we get to the near two-week time frame, which will be next Monday, we'll start to see people who have been in isolation or in quarantine for an appropriate period of time. And so when they do seek care for something else, like if they're having leg pain or if they're having abdominal pain, those who have truly been in isolation for that 14-day are less challenging for us to work up, because in the hospital, we consider them the lowest risk because they've been without symptoms for at least 14 days in this environment, and we can then treat them with the full capacity of the hospital as opposed to somebody who might have the COVID infection.
Well, Georgianne, thank you very much for your call. Senator, we're coming down the home stretch now. I know you have some concluding comments for those that have joined us here today.
Can we take a last call, you?
Oh, sure, yep, we can do it, yep. We'll go to Calvina. Calvina, go ahead, you're live with Senator Brewster.
Okay, I'm Calvina Harris from Duquesne, and I work for the elections, and I hire people to work outside. I need to know how I need to have my workers dress, what I need to put on them to protect them, because we have a lot of people coming to the polls and they're out in the cold, the rain for at least 5.5 hours, the first shift, and then we get a new shift, and I need to know what day that will be.
Okay. Thank you, Calvina, for calling, and thank you for all the work you do. First of all, as of today, we'll be moving the primary into June 2nd. We're hoping by then we'll see some real movement as to the status of the virus in Pennsylvania. To your point, the other thing that's going on nationwide, and particularly in Pennsylvania now, is the early voting. And folks can apply for the early voting application online. Unlike the absentee ballot where you needed a medical reason or you were going to be out of town, you can vote early. And that process has already started. It would have been implemented in April had we kept the election on the 28th. So that will limit the amount of time that folks will have to either work inside the poll or even work outside on behalf of candidates. But to your specific question, I'm going to rely on the Election Bureau and the Allegheny County, our county executive. We work closely with him, and we will set hopefully some standards between now and June 2nd, depending on the condition of where we're at with the virus. In other words, if it's still at a level, we could even move the election. It's not likely because we would probably go more to early balloting where the folks wouldn't even come to the poll if it's still bad. If it's clearing up, then we would then go and make sure that we are secondarily protecting people that are working for candidates or working for the Election Bureau with masks and gloves and whatever else we needed to have available to you, Calvina. But right now, that decision hasn't been made, but it's a very good point. So thank you.
Calvina, thank you for your call, Senator. I know we're coming on a home stretch here. Do you have concluding comments for those that are with us?
Yes, thank you, Hugh. First of all, let me thank you, Baird, for being our moderator, and I really want to thank Dr. For his comments. Well represented tonight, Dr. Suyama. A lot of good, strong medical questions. And I want to thank all those who called in and were able to get through. I want to thank those who stayed on the line to listen. And anyone else that did stay on, you can stay on the line and by voicemail leave your question, and we will get back to you with an answer so you're not completely left out. And as mentioned earlier, feel free to call my offices at 412-380-2242 or go to the website, senatorbrewster.com. And again, just closing out, Doctor, I want to thank you so much for what you've done and the work you do in the private sector, and in addition to helping us in government trying to get accurate information out to our constituents. So thank you so much for being a partner tonight, Dr. Suyama.
No, thank you very much for your leadership, sir, and I look forward to hearing more about what you're doing for our community in the future. So thanks again.
Thank you, Senator, and thank you, Doctor. Thank you again for all those that have joined us for Senator Brewster's live telephone town hall. You've been a wonderful audience, and enjoy the rest of your evening.
Thank you.